Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Joe Lynham, standing in for Mandy Johnston this week, and I'll be keeping you company for the next hour. Coming up on today's show, as the struggle for political supremacy in Venezuela goes on, we look at the man at the centre of it all, Nicolas Maduro. Pre-pandemic, it was one of the highest margin airlines in the world, but in recent times, Aer Lingus has gone from one of the IAG's top performers to the bottom of the class. Aviation expert Jerry Byrne joins us to discuss. And big tech has often been seen as too big to be reined in by regulation, but that might be changing as lawmakers are targeting well-known brands like Apple, Amazon, Microsoft and Meta, and we'll be finding out about the differing approaches being taken on both sides of the Atlantic. You can email us, takingstock@newstalk.com, or also comment on Twitter, @StockNT. Now, they've often been seen as too big to be reined in by regulation, but that might be changing as lawmakers on both sides of the Atlantic are targeting well-known brands such as Apple, Amazon, Microsoft and Meta. And to discuss that, let's speak to Edith Hancock, the competition reporter with Politico, based in Brussels. Hello, Edith.
Hi.
So, tell us what, let's start with Europe, which is your patch. What are the Europeans doing to rein in the power of big tech?
So a new piece of legislation just came into full effect this year called the Digital Markets Act. And that's one of the flagship new legal tools that the European Commission has to do exactly that, to rein in big tech. Historically, the Commission used to try to go after companies like Google and Apple, companies like Google and Microsoft, for example, under traditional antitrust investigations, and they found that they were getting tied up in court battles for a very long time. And so this piece of legislation is designed to essentially cut out the middleman and designate a handful of companies as so-called gatekeepers, which means that they basically have a monopoly over certain parts of the digital economy. So for Google, that would be search engines. For Apple, that would be the iPhone operating system. And then leading on to that, the piece of legislation basically sets out a clear list of do's and don'ts designed to stop those companies basically using their existing market power in those platforms to squeeze out smaller rivals and kind of entrench their own market position.
In terms of the Digital Markets Act, what will change in the day-to-day interaction between regulators and big tech?
So there's a lot of back and forth between big tech and the regulators on this. At the moment, it means that there are quite a few workshops that happen in Brussels where companies like Google put forward the changes that they've made to comply with the rules and comply with this list of do's and don'ts. And then that often means that competitors to Google, which would be maybe their online shopping websites, maybe their travel booking websites, like Trainline, for example, something like that, will also attend these workshops, and they basically hash out what they're happy with, what they're not happy with. So you have a lot of this back and forth dialogue. You also have companies under far more investigations at quite an increased speed than they'd had historically. And you're basically seeing the scrutiny kind of become a little bit more intense.
Now, the Americans have taken a slightly different approach. Rather than having a big swathe of laws, an overarching set of rules, they're taking individual lawsuits against some of the big tech companies, notably from the Federal Trade Commission, but also the DOJ, the Department of Justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, because it kind of speaks a little bit to the difficulty that I think the US has with being able to pass legislation that the EU is able to with, for example, the DSA and the DMA. And so you do see them drawing on these historic methods of going after companies with very, very old, centuries old, even antitrust laws.
Give us an example of some of the cases that are currently underway.
Well, just recently, there was a court case against Google's search engine, which was very interesting because basically the ruling was based on the fact that Google was paying other companies to allow its search engine to be, the dominant one that was used on devices, for example. So there's some of that. There's quite a few cases against Google, major cases against Apple as well.
Okay, well, let's go back to, you just finished talking about the Google antitrust situation. If that reaches its full conclusion, will there be anything more in terms of sanctions against Google other than a big fine? Could they, for example, order the breakup of the company?
Yes, that is something there is a possibility that could happen. That's also something in the DMA as well. So European Commission officials would be able to fine companies up to 10% of their annual worldwide turnover. They can increase that fine if they find that there's been repeat offences. And if there continue to be repeat offences, one of the things that they can order is a breakup. What will be interesting to see, though, is whether the European Commission would want to do that when these are all companies that are based in the US, or whether it's the US regulator who's going to have a little bit more clout to be able to do that.
Now, famously, the old phrase is that US innovates and the Europeans regulate. So do you get a sense that the Europeans will act first to tame big tech?
I think that's what you're already seeing now, to be honest. I think that with all this swathe of new laws that have come into place, this is really what the Commission excels best at. It's creating rules. And as you say, you know, the US does innovate. So I think you're seeing a lot of that. I think there's been an interesting discussion recently about the fact that there's a lot more rhetoric in the US than there used to be about taking on dominant companies. But this is something that Europe has been grappling with for quite a while now as well.
The Americans would say, of course, Edith, that the Europeans are being anti-competitive and that they are zeroing in on American tech companies because they don't have any huge indigenous European companies that are really dominant worldwide.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting take on it. And, you know, if you look at the handful of companies that have been designated under the Digital Markets Act, it is true the majority of them are US based. But it's the legislation's kind of a movable feast in a way. So this is only the first handful of companies that have been classed as gatekeepers. We could see other companies coming into that as well. We do have a European gatekeeper as well in Booking. And of course, there's ByteDance, which owns TikTok.
Indeed.
Which is not European, but yes, exactly.
Is there any coordination between the Americans and the Europeans when it comes to this issue on technology?
Yes, there is. You quite often see both officials from the US and the EU talking at conferences, for example, on either side of the Atlantic. There is a level of dialogue in something called the Trade and Technology Council, and you see officials from either side of the Atlantic engaging and talking at quite a high level about policy strategy there. And you do hear about information exchanges between officials on both sides as well.
What sense do you get about whether things will change in America post the election in November and the inauguration in January? Do you get a sense that Trump will be more lenient on big tech than perhaps a President Harris?
It's a little difficult to say. What I would say is there isn't anything to suggest that the outcome of the election would drastically change the approach that the FTC and the DOJ are taking against big tech. I think that you'd already seen these actions underway while Trump was president the first time. And interestingly as well, J.D. Vance has been a vocal supporter of breaking up big tech companies. But what I would say is I think that the Trump administration probably has more, has different priorities at the top of its to-do list. So I wouldn't necessarily say anything would be drastically different. Just I think you might see that rhetoric maybe not as high profile as before.
I get a sense that the GOP and Republican voters normally think that big technology has a left-wing bias. I always wonder whether they think that Google changes their algorithms to favor more kind of progressive liberal policies.
That's an interesting thought. I think it's true that misinformation and this kind of siloing of information has been a really major topic in recent elections, especially in the European elections as well. I would say that, generally speaking, I think it's very fair to say that Republican voters are more pro sort of more of a laissez-faire approach, less regulatory intervention than the left wing is. But it will be interesting to see, especially after the outcome of the vote, how this kind of policy debate around misinformation evolves.
We've had our European elections. We're about to form a new European Commission. Would you say that there are any plans in a second von der Leyen commission to introduce even further rules of the road for big tech?
I don't think that that's going to be something where we're going to see loads more pieces of regulation. I think we've heard von der Leyen speaking in various different summits saying that, you know, the last mandate was the mandate of legislation. That's when we had all this raft of new rules come in, including the DMA, the DSA, the AI Act as well. And now this is the mandate of enforcement. So I think a lot of the effort is going to go into pooling all the resources that that they have at their disposal to be able to enforce what they already have.
Thanks, Edith. That's Edith Hancock, competition reporter with Politico.
Thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, as the political power struggle in Venezuela rumbles on, we'll be taking a look at the landscape that has allowed the man at the centre of it all to come to power and not go away.
Y puedo decir ante el pueblo de Venezuela y ante el mundo, soy Nicolás Maduro Moro, presidente reelecto de la República Bolivariana de Venezuela, y voy a defender nuestra democracia, nuestra ley y a nuestro pueblo.
We need the Biden administration and Vice President Harris to send a very strong statement to the Maduro regime that this time he cannot steal the elections. It's obvious that it has been outrageous what they have done. They have stolen an election that everything indicates that is 80 for the opposition, 20 for the chavismo.
We've seen the announcement by the Venezuelan Electoral Commission. We have serious concerns that the result announced does not reflect the will or the votes of the Venezuelan people.
In a vote riddled with irregularities and citizens angrily protesting the government's actions, on July 29th, Nicolas Maduro was declared the winner of Venezuela's presidential election when the electoral authority declared him the winner without any supporting data. So today we're looking at the man at the centre of it all and ask how this one-time bus driver rose through the political ranks to become Venezuela's enduring hard man, strong man, leader, whatever you want to call him. John Farmer is the editor-in-chief at Latin News and editor of Latin American Weekly Report and joins us on the line. Hello, John.
Good morning, Joe.
So, John, for those of us unfamiliar with Nicolas Maduro, who is he?
Nicolas Maduro is basically the chosen successor of Hugo Chavez, who came to power back in 1999. And he died of cancer in 2013. Nicolas Maduro had been serving as his foreign minister. And shortly before Chavez died, he essentially said, Maduro is the man who should take over from me. So Chavez, if we sort of go back to Chavez to kind of put some of this into historical context, or Comandante Chavez, as he was known, because he was a former paratrooper leader. He's a kind of larger-than-life figure. He was a populist strongman. He came up with this political project, which he called 21st Century Socialism. And this was, you know, a sort of fusion of Marxist rhetoric and his messianic leadership. So his government enforced state control of key industries, particularly the state oil company PDVSA, and that's, as you know, the mainstay of the economy. Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves in the world, and Chavez used this as a cash cow. So he sort of milked its funds to finance social projects or or misiones, mm-hmm. as he called them. And this would sort of bring education and health services to the poor sectors of society. And these, you know, these made him hugely popular with the poor who'd been neglected by most sort of previous governments. And I think it's really important to remember, you know, populist strongmen, they don't just come out of nowhere. So when Chavez came to power in 1999, there was massive public disillusionment with the political class in Venezuela. So there'd been this two-party power-sharing agreement known as Punto Fijo, which was between the country's established political parties. And this had been in place since 1958, after the dictatorship of Marcos Perez Jimenez. And these Punto Fijo governments, they shared power and oil wealth, regardless of which one of them had won the elections. But most of the population felt very excluded and marginalized. The irony, of course, is that when Chavez came to power in 1999, and he'd sort of promised to sweep all of these unpopular governments aside, and he'd govern for the people, he shared the oil wealth, but not power. So there was corruption on a monumental scale, but he was canny enough to share enough of the oil wealth in the form of those social programs and stuff I mentioned earlier to really underpin his popularity.
Now, at the backbone of all of this in economic terms is oil, as you said. Venezuela has the largest proven reserves of oil. Are they simply unable to get the oil out of the ground, or why have oil exports collapsed?
So, I mean, when Chavez came to power, he sort of used petrodiplomacy. He was supplying cheap oil to sort of small Caribbean countries. This won him a lot of support in regional institutions in the Americas. There was no plan for investing properly in the oil sector. It was taken over by his cronies. And then basically, after Maduro came to power in 2013, and you no longer had the oil boom, which Chavez had managed to benefit from, production had plummeted due to this colossal mismanagement and the lack of investment in the oil sector. So, I mean, we used to talk about Venezuela would have production of sort of over 3 million barrels per day, traditionally. But recently, the latest OPEC figures from June is down at sort of 850,000. So it's just a colossal fall in production. And without that, it being the mainstay of the economy, you know, Maduro hasn't had the money to both provide his supporters with his sort of bully bourgeoisie and keep them happy, and also retain these social programs, which are really at the core of Chavez's support.
Now, GDP per head was around $7,000 in Venezuela about 20 to 25 years ago. It's still at that level in 2024. Such is the mismanagement of the economy. Now, I'm guessing U.S. sanctions have not helped, though.
No, U.S. sanctions haven't helped, obviously. But, you know, we can't lose sight of the fact that this was just colossal mismanagement and massive corruption, and just a complete lack of investment in the oil sector, taking out anyone who had any sort of knowledge of the way that the oil sector functioned, and just sticking in Bolivarian cronies who, you know, didn't know what they were doing, and just ran the thing, just hollowed out the whole oil sector.
Now, there was an election a week and a half ago or so. It took ages to get the results, and when they came through, they did not exactly please the opposition party, which had a huge amount of support, at least on the streets.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, initially, the electoral authorities came out and they said that Maduro had won these elections by 51% to 44% after 80% of the count had been completed, and the result was irreversible. But the electoral authorities, like all the state institutions in Venezuela, are completely in the pocket of the Bolivarian government. In fact, the head of the electoral authorities, Elvis Amoroso, he's a personal friend of Maduro's and is a member of the ruling party. What the electoral authorities have not done is they have not published the final voter tally sheets. And this is what the opposition are demanding. This is what much of the international community is demanding, that they publish these. And the opposition has denounced electoral fraud on an epic scale.
Now, the official candidate for president who supposedly lost the election was Mr. Gonzalez, but he's not really the leader of the opposition movement, is he?
No, he's not. So Maria Corina Machado, she's the real opposition figurehead. She is hugely charismatic, and she is really the sort of star of the show. But she was barred because of this, essentially. She was barred from running for the opposition by the electoral authorities. And so she had to basically parachute in somebody. So that the Edmundo Gonzalez was the man for the job. He's a sort of, in the nicest possible terms, he's a bit of a non-entity. He's a very, very respectable diplomat, but he obviously doesn't have anything like the charisma she had. But she was able to, just by endorsing him, really pass on her popularity. And this is why people were prepared to back him. And really what the opposition has demonstrated, what she did by doing this, was displayed a level of unity which has been really absent from what the opposition has, as it's desperately struggled against the Bolivarian government for years. And it's tried all kinds of things to dislodge them. But fundamentally, it's been fragmented, it's been disunited, and it hasn't really known sort of how to proceed. But she's really galvanized them in a way that we haven't seen in the recent past.
Of course, there are plenty of examples from the past in which democracy was subverted and Nicolas Maduro was shown a capacity for real ruthlessness to cling on to power. You might tell us a bit about his track record on this score.
I mean, Maduro has been subverting democracy for years to ensure there's no threat to his power. He's always been careful to look, though, like he's not doing it. So his control of the Supreme Court in this is key. When the opposition actually managed to win a majority in congressional elections back in 2015 and, you know, thought it could taste some power, he used the Supreme Court then to totally denude it of power, to assume its power. So the court accused it of being in contempt for swearing in three deputies who'd been suspended by the court, ironically now, over alleged charges of electoral fraud at the time. And then in 2017, Maduro held elections for a constituent assembly, which was duly stacked full of loyalists. And these elections were widely seen as having been fraudulent. But not just that, it was a blatant power grab. I mean, the purpose of this constituent assembly ostensibly was to rewrite the constitution. Again, Chavez had already convened a constituent assembly for this precise purpose, you know, soon after he came in 1999. So there was no need at all to rewrite the constitution. And Maduro's constituent assembly, it had no intention whatsoever of drafting a new constitution, which it never did, by the way. Mm. It just set up to, you know, arrogate the power of the opposition-controlled Congress that had come in 2015.
And back in 2019, the country thought that it would be getting a new leader in the shape of Juan Guaido. He has subsequently fled the country and now resides in exile in the United States.
Yes, exactly. So the Constituent Assembly had illegitimately called 2018 elections when Maduro was first re-elected. And as you say, this was, some of your listeners will no doubt remember this, when Juan Guaido came in, he declared himself interim president in early 2019. And Guaido did this because he argued that those elections in 2018, when Maduro was re-elected, were illegitimate. So Guaido won a lot of international support from the US, yeah, lots of European and Latin American countries recognized him as interim president. But ultimately, he never wielded real power, and he couldn't drive Maduro out of office. And this is because he just couldn't persuade the military to abandon Maduro and the regime. So the military, along with the Supreme Court, is really what is propping Maduro up. He's tried to insure himself against a coup by giving huge privileges and influence to the military, you know, both in terms of profitable ventures that they control and political power, and really just by absurdly inflating the top brass. So, you know, Venezuela has 2,000 odd admirals and generals. So, you know, to put that into perspective, the top brass of the US, a global superpower, is about half that size. So, you know, the armed forces, or the Bolivarian armed forces, I should say, to give them their current title, and really to just show how politicized they are, a military high command of those armed forces have a real vested interest in the regime surviving.
So what happens now? The Americans, the big player in the continent, are distracted with their own elections. So does it look as if Maduro is going to get away with this?
I think he is going to get away with it, because essentially what he has is he has full control of the state institutions, as I mentioned before, but crucially the one that he has control over is the Supreme Court. Now, he's used the Supreme Court in the past to essentially do his bidding. And in a very, very sinister development, he has sent the electoral tally sheets, or he's required that the electoral authorities send these electoral tally sheets that haven't been published, and which the opposition insists demonstrate that they won these elections by a landslide. He sent them to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is calling in the presidential candidates who competed in these elections over the course of this week. So in addition to Maduro and Gonzalez, there were also, you know, about eight candidates who had absolutely no chance of winning. But all of this he's using just to spin things out, you know, gain time, and to use the Supreme Court in the way that he has on many occasions before to try and lend a sort of sheen of legitimacy to proceedings, even though the Supreme Court is completely stacked with his loyalists. And ultimately, I don't think there's any great doubt as to what they're going to conclude has happened here. But what they have said is they're going to require time. So they're going to require initially up to sort of 15 days to draw up a report, but they might need to extend that. So it's really just spinning out the process. But it's all essentially a farce, because, as I say, the court is completely in his hands.
So even if Machado or Gonzalez were actually to overturn the result of last month's election, would they be even in a position to bring about any real change?
Well, I think that's the whole issue, yes. I mean, the Congress, the judiciary, all of the other institutions of state, they're totally controlled by the Bolivarian government. So, you know, that wouldn't change if Maduro actually admitted defeat and Gonzalez came in. So I think we would see that Gonzalez would be seriously constrained, and there's every possibility that, you know, they could impeach him on some trumped up charges without much difficulty.
And in the meantime, an estimated 7 million Venezuelans have left the country, have emigrated in abject poverty and spread themselves all over South, Central and North America.
Yes, they have. And, you know, it's mind-blowing emigration. And this is all down to the just the abject failure of the Maduro regime. And this is one of the real concerns of the rest of the region. I mean, obviously, the rest of the region is desperate to see a democratic outcome in Venezuela, but it's also terrified of what may the humanitarian catastrophe that could ensue, because lots of these countries are really reeling from the number of Venezuelan migrants that have fled into their countries. Colombia in particular, obviously bordering Venezuela, and Colombia's president Gustavo Petro, he is a leftist. He has sought much closer ties with the Venezuelan government, and he is, at least he claims, that he's trying to apply sort of a degree of diplomatic pressure, or at least keep diplomatic channels open in a bid to sort of encourage a democratic outcome to this entire debacle. But how much Maduro is genuinely listening to him, I think is doubtful.
Yeah. John, thank you so much for your expertise today. That's John Farmer, Editor-in-Chief at Latin News and editor of Latin American Weekly Report on Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks, Jay.
This is Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, with both the lowest operating profit and lowest operating profit margin of the four carriers within the IAG group of airlines, what does the future hold for Aer Lingus? And to what extent can it keep up with the increased competition from across the pond? We'll be digging into that just after this short break, so don't go anywhere. Now, pre-pandemic, it was one of the highest margin airlines in the world. But last year, Aer Lingus had both the lowest operating profit at €225 million and the lowest operating profit margin at 9.9% of the four carriers within the IAG family of airlines, including British Airways and Iberia. So why has it fallen from its place as one of IAG's top performers? And what can they do to make themselves as competitive as possible in the medium and short term? Well, Jerry Byrne is an aviation analyst and journalist and joins me on the line. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning, John.
In relation to Aer Lingus, how would you describe the health of the airline at the moment?
Not brilliant. It has just recovered from a very, very bruising industrial action by the pilots, which has cost it an additional $55 million, I think, that into the year it wasn't expecting to lose. It's also more bruising activity, suffering quite significant competition from several American carriers who have expanded their offering to Ireland. And indeed, there's at least one JetBlue which is coming to Ireland for the first time. So that's a big problem for them. It's competing for both leisure and business class passengers, although I think it's suffering most on the leisure side from that kind of competition.
Yeah. Now, will the strike action, I mean, there's a fair bit of stuff to break down. The industrial action that we saw at the end of June and the beginning of July, the airline says it's going to cost it €55 million. Do you think that's going to damage the airline, firstly, with its customers, and second of all, with IAG, its bosses?
There's no doubt that there has been reputational damage, and customers would be slightly wary, I think, of booking long-term if they feel there's going to be a repeat of that sort of action. Bear in mind also that other unions in Aer Lingus have a kind of a parity agreement so that nobody can get out of step, as it were, with percentage increases elsewhere in the airline. So the mechanics, the ground crew, clerical staff, they're all going to be looking for increases. And indeed, their unions have had several meetings recently raising this very point. So they can look forward to at least some tough negotiations with these unions, and one hopes not industrial action.
Yeah, this is right. The cabin crew and the ground staff might now be entitled to further pay rises in line with what the pilots got last month. So the pilots got roughly 17.5% or something over a few years.
Over a few years, yeah.
Yeah, whereas the ground crew and the cabin crew had agreed a slightly smaller number, and they will come back cap in hand to management and say, you need to match this, I presume.
Yeah, indeed. And against that, they are also facing a cost retrenchment, as it were. There will be, I think, some retrenchment at the airline, which may affect staffing. Lynn Embledon, the chief executive, has said that she's going to look at the worker routes to see if any of those, I presume, can be pruned. They're also facing a cap, as it were, the cap on the amount of expansion they can have at Dublin Airport. This is a Green Party imposition on Dublin Airport, which has limited the number of passengers it can handle in a year to 32 million. And they're going to reach that this year very, very shortly, which is going to be a problem going forward. And, you know, obviously the thing that Aer Lingus should be trying to do is increase the number of passengers it's carrying. But there's a, you know, the airport, as it were, will have to impose a limit on the amount of growth it can enjoy. And this, of course, applies to all airlines, Ryanair included, and other airlines that serve.
And Ryanair have been very vociferous in their objections to the passenger cap. And they want to, everybody wants to raise it to 40 million within the airport firmament. But in the meantime, who knows what Fingal County Council would do in terms of this autumn. Now, Aer Lingus have announced three new routes this week. Is that an effort to get back on the front foot?
Well, indeed, it's suffering a lot of competition, as I said earlier, from American airlines coming in here, which are stealing its lunch, as it were. You know, travellers that might have gone directly to the United States via Aer Lingus may now be enticed to American airlines. So the objective of the exercise, I think, is to try and expand outside of U.S. routes. But it's hard to know if that this is going to be a game changer for the airline.
Now, you mentioned JetBlue and the American airlines. The most profitable routes are long haul, of course, and of course to the United States. Does it make any sense for them to try to compete with Ryanair on the short-haul European routes? And then this brings into question whether they have the right aircraft and whether they can get the right aircraft in short order to be able to do those kind of short-haul flights.
Well, they actually have good aircraft for the short-haul flights. I mean, they have a large fleet of A320s and increasing the number of A321s. These are the newer Airbus offering. What they are looking for, and this is an interesting point, they're looking for the XLR. This is the extra long range Airbus 321, which is basically, if you like, an A320 on steroids. It's a longer fuselage. It's a narrow body aircraft, whereas most transatlantic aircraft tend to be wide bodies, you know, jumbos and 777s and that sort of thing. And there's an interesting trend in aviation the last few years, which probably was highlighted by the decision by Boeing to plump for the Dreamliner, the 787, which is not quite a wide body. It is wider than the, shall we say, an A321, but it's not quite a wide body. And it was designed for fast service of what one might call long, thin routes. In other words, routes which didn't have a huge number of passengers on them, but were still worth serving. And if Aer Lingus had similar aircraft like the XLR, which can fly across the Atlantic, even though it's a narrow body, can fly the Atlantic quite happily, it would be able to establish new routes to other cities, smaller cities, shall we say. Like, for example, if they wanted to serve Nashville, which is an important center in the south of United States, it wouldn't justify putting an A320, you know, a wide-body aircraft on that route. But it might work with an XLR. And the beauty of the XLR is if it's not flying the Atlantic, and it can just as happily fly locally. You know, it can fly close-haul or short-haul European routes. And in fact, it could fly from, shall we say, Paris to Dublin, and then its next flight could be across the Atlantic. It's a very, very flexible aircraft. And they're hoping to get more of them. They were due to get four, but the first two, when they were ready, the airline was on strike. And IAG, the holding company, said, look, you guys aren't ready for this. We're giving them to somebody else. And I think they possibly went to one of the Spanish airlines in the group. They stand a fairly good chance of getting two this year, but they really would like more. And I think those are the interesting sort of aircraft. They will give the airline much more flexibility. They will have tremendous support for short-haul routes and also be able to launch new long-haul routes. If you wanted to go, I mentioned Nashville earlier, if you wanted to go to Nashville via Aer Lingus, you would be offered a flight. Now, it's not to say you have to take it. You can find other flights. But you would be offered a flight via Heathrow, whereby they will fly you from Dublin to Heathrow, going the wrong way, to pick up a British Airways flight to Nashville from Heathrow. And that flight then comes back over Dublin. You know, so when you add in the hour here, the hour there, half a day gone before you even start your journey to Nashville. So that sort of an offering is not enticing, especially to business travellers. But direct routes using aircraft like the XLR, they could be quite innovative there.
What kind of relationship does Aer Lingus have with IAG, which sits above British Airways and Iberia and Aer Lingus itself? Is it one of deliberate internal competition between those airlines, or do they keep them apart?
I think they keep them apart. Obviously, if British Airways, for example, wants to launch a route from the UK to Ireland and says it can do it cheaper than Aer Lingus or more profitably than Aer Lingus, I think Aer Lingus would have to justify holding on to that route. But by and large, I think they tend to up it separately, in a corporate sense, together. For example, as I mean, again, I hate to keep bringing up Nashville. I'm never going to go there.
It's a lovely city, apparently.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, the reason why you're encouraged by Aer Lingus to fly to British Airways, to fly to London to pick up a flight to Nashville, shall we say, because that will be your Aer Lingus is now operating as a feeder airline for British Airways. And that Heathrow connection is very, very important. And Aer Lingus is very, very important in supplying passengers to British Airways long-haul routes.
Do you get a sense that BA kind of steps aside when it comes to the Dublin-Heathrow route or, for example, the Dublin-Madrid route for Iberia?
No, I don't think so. I think there is competition there. And it's largely a question of capacity as well, I think. You know, should Aer Lingus step aside when, shall we say, Iberia can't service the route? It's a big route. It's a very busy route. And just like the Dublin-London route, I mean, British Airways slots coming into Dublin. You know, Aer Lingus doesn't have the entire Dublin corridor to itself. It has to share it with IAG.
Yeah, and finally, would you say for people in Ireland that there is a residual loyalty to the former national flag carrier?
Oh, undoubtedly there is. The quality of service, I think, has a lot to do with it as well. You know, you do... The handling of a passenger, I think, is a little bit more intimate than it is with a low-cost carrier like Ryanair or Wizz or any of those. You do get treated a little better. You pay a little more for it, but I think a lot of people are prepared for that.
Jerry, thanks so much for joining us. That's Jerry Byrne.
You're very welcome.
The aviation analyst and journalist. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're also available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. My thanks to my guests this week and for their valuable insights. Thanks to Simon Keane, who is producing, Steve Daunt on research, Hugo Da Silva Scott on sound. And any comments on today's items, you can email us, takingstock@newstalk.com. The Anton Savage Show is up next with all your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Joe Lynham, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.